I'm Andy Borowitz, in for Leonard Lopate. Not sure if that jaunty jazz music is really appropriate for the topic we're about to discuss, but I'll just wait for it to fade a little bit. Thank you. In 2012, Gilberto Valle, the man dubbed the Cannibal Cop, created headlines around the world when prosecutors revealed charges against him, including that he planned to kidnap, kill, and cook his own wife. We're joined now by Robert Kolker, an assistant editor at New York Magazine. His article, A Dangerous Mind, raises a number of serious issues about the whole saga, including that the trial seemed to be about two different things: the actual charges against Valle and the question of what he might do in the future if he were allowed to go free. The article appears in the January 13th issue of the magazine, and I'm pleased to welcome Mr. Kolker to the Leonard Lopate Show. Hello.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
So that's a tough act to follow after Rita Moreno, and that was very uplifting and happy, so now you can bring us all down about human nature. And
I'll start by saying that she's wonderful, Rita Moreno.
Isn't she amazing?
Terrific. Yeah, she's great.
And looks incredible.
Yes.
Okay. Now that's the end of our happy conversation. Now we'll talk about your article. Okay, I think a lot of people remember this. This was a very lurid story, obviously, and we all read about the Cannibal Cop in the tabloids and elsewhere when it happened. Could you refresh our memory, and for those who somehow didn't notice this story when it came out the first time, let us just walk us through what happened here?
Sure. The trial was almost a year ago.
Mm-hmm.
This was a man in his 20s who was a police officer. His wife was a teacher and then suddenly a stay-at-home mom. And one day his wife discovers on his computer that he's been chatting on emails and participating on a fetish board, almost like a Facebook for very, very rare sexual fetishes.
And what's the name of this fetish board?
It's called the Dark Fetish Network.
Okay, DFN.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
He was using a pseudonym, and he was discussing with various people he had met on that board about plans to, as you said, abduct and cook and eat, and kill not just his wife, but many other people in his life, old college friends, coworkers of hers, his supervisor at the 26th Precinct in Harlem. She immediately took the baby and left town, went back to her parents' house, and continued to monitor the computer because she had installed spyware on the computer, and saw even more stuff like that, called the FBI, and very soon after that, he was arrested. And he made the papers, and the bits and pieces that were in the papers were so provocative that it all seemed like this was a very simple open and shut case. What his defense lawyers ended up arguing was that all the government had were emails, that there was no physical evidence to back up anything that he was talking about. He would say, "I'll bring her to my house in the mountains," and he has no house in the mountains. And he would, he didn't have any of the tools or implements, not even knives, to be able to do any of the things he was doing. And so they argued the fantasy defense, which some of your listeners might recognize as a defense that sexual predators sometimes use. People who've been caught in sting operations, pedophiles, they say, this was all a fantasy. It was the internet. It's like the internet's like a masked ball. You never think anybody's serious on the internet.
Mm-hmm.
The fantasy defense sometimes works and sometimes doesn't. But in the case of the, Valle case, the Cannibal Cop case, it's an extraordinary, interesting test case, legally speaking, because looked at a certain way, there really is no physical evidence. There are only emails that betray his thoughts. And so the question becomes, is this a thought prosecution? And as you said, was the jury really convicting based on what he might do in the future, not on what he's done so far?
I want to talk a little bit more about this guy and his background and his marriage and all that. But let me just stop with one thing you just said. People make this distinction between the internet and real life. They say, it's just the internet. It's just fantasy. Is that over now? I mean, when people are on the internet now and they think that they're engaging in fantasy, is the internet now real life and things they say on the internet? I'll give you an example. On Twitter, oftentimes you'll see people will make death threats. They don't like a pundit, or they don't like somebody has said something bad about Justin Bieber that they don't like because they are a believer and they have their religion has been offended. And so they'll threaten somebody on the internet. Is that threat now no longer a tweet? Is that now is that assault? Could that be prosecuted?
That's going through the courts now, too. There actually was a case about that back in the 90s, which was similar to this one in that it was people, you know, chewing the fat on the internet and then suddenly saying threatening things. And it was prosecuted not as a conspiracy to kidnap case like the Valley case, but as a threat case, like a verbal assault case. And that particular individual was acquitted because it seemed clear from the emails that they were just jawboning and that it wasn't a real threat. But you could certainly see an instance, particularly in with federal crimes like threatening the president, where it starts to get a little more dicey. You could really look at that question of what's authentic on the internet and what isn't two ways. One, you could say, you know, it's a new world and we live in public and you got to watch what you do, and actions are actions, and, you know, you don't have license to do extra stuff just because you're anonymous on the internet. And then the other way to look at it is that the back when the law was evolving to incorporate people's intent into cases like attempted conspiracy or attempted murder, it was very difficult to know what people's thoughts were. And so you really needed real-life action to back up the charges, to put someone in jail.
But now we know what everybody's thinking all the time.
Yep.
Because of the internet.
Exactly.
So
you need less and less real-life evidence, particularly in terrorism cases. There have been something like 200 prosecutions against, you know, individuals accused of bringing material aid to, you know, terror groups. Sometimes they have the physical evidence, but in lots of those cases, they've started by monitoring email communications. And that's really the beginning of the investigation. And then, of course, school shooting cases are like that, too.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody emails with somebody else, a student emails and starts talking about maybe doing something. They're arrested and brought to justice whether or not they actually own a firearm or have an explosive. And so thought prosecutions are – they aren't here, but they're coming. And that's what makes the Valley case interesting, as troubling as it is to look into the particulars of it.
Right. And I keep on saying I want to get back and talk about him more, but then you keep on raising these interesting points. For example, with thought prosecutions, doesn't this bump up against some of our First Amendment protections, too? I mean, if we're saying, well, you know, the internet is just a forum and we can say what we want to, and we shouldn't be, you know, we may say we want the president of the United States to die, but that's not the same thing as plotting an assassination. Isn't this exactly the kind of tyranny that we were trying to protect ourselves from in the Bill of Rights?
Right. And of course, different crimes have different standards of proof. What makes the Valley case interesting is that it's a conspiracy case, which is a very, very low barrier
right.
to proving. All you have to do is call up your buddy and talk about it, and you're well on your way to a conspiracy case.
Right.
So he's talking to individuals on the internet. It doesn't matter if he knows who they are or where they live, what their names are. The government is already well on its way to making a conspiracy case. What his lawyer said is, if it's all fantasy, where's the conspiracy?
Right. Okay. So let's talk about this dude now. What was his background? He was a New York cop. What was his childhood like, and how did he meet his wife?
He went to Archbishop Molloy High School. He grew up in Queens. He went to the University of Maryland, apparently did well there and had lots of friends.
As we learn in the story. Yeah.
in interviews, even people who were on the witness stand who were targeted by him all said that they never ever had a moment with him that was threatening or awkward. He never lost his temper, never took any menacing action toward anyone that we know about. He had what we know from the forensic psychiatrist who interviewed him on behalf of the defense. We know from that interview that he, you know, had a fairly repressed Catholic childhood. It appears that his wife is the first person he was intimate with. He was a very, very shy and chivalrous, you know, guy who would barely kiss on the first date. Meanwhile, he had this active fantasy life, which was codified as a teenager, which of course he never shared with anyone because he was too ashamed.
And I think I remember this detail from your piece that his fantasy life was really ignited by the Jim Carrey film The Mask.
Yeah,
that seems like a bizarre place for this all to have started. But what was the moment in that movie that set him off?
Well, I guess he locked in on an image of Cameron Diaz being, you know, tied up or abducted and in peril. And the point that the psychiatrist, Dr. Park Dietz, who's interviewed John Hinckley Jr. and Jeffrey Dahmer, and, you know, he's a high-profile guy. What he says in the New York Magazine story is that you know, the real fantasy for Gilberto Valle is the woman in distress. And so when he talks about abducting women, he talks about chloroform, which Dr. Dietz at least interprets as a very gentle way of abducting someone.
Mm-hmm.
Then, of course, things don't get so gentle when it comes to, you know, cooking and whatnot. But the case to be made in his defense is that he wants the woman in peril, and that the fantasy basically ends, you know, right as it begins, this image.
I see. I'm speaking with Bob Kolker about the conviction of former cop Gilberto Valle on charges of plotting to kill and eat women. His article, A Dangerous Mind, appears in the January 13th issue of New York Magazine. And you can find a link to that article on our show page. We'll be back with more after a break. I'm Andy Borowitz, in for Leonard Lopate, and I am talking to Robert Kolker. He's an assistant editor at New York Magazine, and his article, A Dangerous Mind, which appears in the January 13th issue, is all about Gilberto Valle, the man who was dubbed the cannibal cop. This was sort of a story that was made for the New York Post at the time, right?
That's right. But the interesting thing about that is that while the daily tabloids in New York were ready to string this guy up in the beginning, by day four or five of the trial, even Andrea Pizer at the Post was writing columns saying that he shouldn't be in jail, that he needed medical attention, but that he wasn't a killer and hadn't done anything violent yet. It was interesting that the jury did not agree and ended up convicting him anyway. And yet, even as we talk about this case, it's hard to imagine being Henry Fonda on that jury and standing up and speaking up on behalf of a man like this. It's hard to stand on principle when you really aren't sure what he might do in the future. And that's where I really argue that this was a pre-crime case.
Mm-hmm. Preventing something from happening at some later date. One of the things that helped influence the jury, I believe, was the nature of the emails and the communication, which were very disturbing. Without getting too graphic, let's say NPR graphic, public radio graphic, can you describe some of the things he talked about doing and who some of his, you know, prospective victims, whether they're fantasy victims or real victims, who they were?
Well, the people were real. He never supplied last names, and he would mix up details about their lives. And he never said exactly where they lived, and sometimes would even say that they lived in different cities from where they lived. So, you know, you can argue that both ways. He's sharing someone's photograph on the internet and obviously talking about them as someone he knows and who he wants to attack. But on the other hand, he's doing certain things to safeguard that their identity would be known. And if he's going to be committing a conspiracy with someone, you know, then the question becomes, at a certain point, you know, they need to know who they are. At any rate, he talks about getting together with each of the people he's talking to on this fetish board and teaming up to kidnap and abduct, chloroform, and, you know, cook and eat these women and often take them away to remote locations while doing it. And he always says the same thing when he's spinning out the fantasy. So in a way, it is a little like if you're on the defense team, you would say, you know, that he's storytelling, that it's group porn storytelling. It's fan fiction almost with real life inspiration. He says things like, she's doomed. You know, he says that a lot. You know, he's kind of a trite storyteller. Some of his sayings are things you might get out of a comic book, but he says, you know, I can't wait to watch it, you know, to see her roasting. And so some of it feels a little rote. And in fact, when they start to make plans in a way that alarmed the prosecution, like talking how much money it might cost to pay somebody to, you know, to help him out or choosing a time to go and do it, even those get a little sketchy because he talks with person A about kidnapping somebody on President's Day weekend. And then he talks to person B about getting a different person on President's Day weekend. And then a third person he talks to talking about a third individual about President's Day weekend. And then President's Day weekend comes and goes and nothing happens. And then he's back online talking to one of these people as if nothing has ever happened. And he starts up the game again. Mm-hmm. Now, the game is a very disturbing game and the thoughts are very disturbing thoughts. And you know, obviously the jury believed that that was enough, that he would be escalating into action. But the defense argues that escalating into action isn't part of a conspiracy case. The question is, was there really conspiracy or not? And they argue there's no physical evidence to suggest it.
Mm-hmm. Now, you mentioned this psychologist, Park Dietz, who interviewed him and tested him. What was his findings? What did he feel? What did he think was wrong with this guy? And did he think he posed a danger?
He believes that he doesn't work for the defense much. He's a prosecution kind of guy.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason for that is that, I don't know if your listeners know this, but the prosecution has to use the opinion of they can't ignore the opinion of a forensic psychiatrist who they engage to work on a case, whereas defense lawyers can go shopping mm-hmm. and get whatever they want. But he was drawn to this case, and he was drawn to it because he knew that it's not enough just to have a paraphilia, which is a fetish. You also have to have something else in your life, some other failure of character, whether you're a sociopath or a psychopath, to act on that paraphilia and be dangerous. And so he wanted to examine this guy to see if there was anything else in his life, any slight indication that he would somehow lose it and act on these fantasies. And he believes it's not even a close call. He believes it's a slam dunk to say that this guy is a inoffensive, pleasant, non-threatening guy. And he really believes he's a false positive. But that said, he's not against monitoring conversations on the Dark Fetish Network or any other website. He's not against trying to find people who might not be false positives.
You have to put yourself in the position of this guy's ex-wife and any of these other victims, prospective victims who were mentioned in the emails and in the chat rooms, and say, well, if you were one of those women, how would you feel about the assessment of this guy as harmless and he's just, he's got some dark hobbies, but let's let him go? I mean, can you sort of feel like maybe they would understandably, I guess this is a loaded question, but if I were his wife, I would say, boy, I'd want him locked up.
Well, I asked Dr. Dietz about that. I said, so how else could this have gone down? And he said, it's possible that the FBI, would learn its lesson and in the future realize they need more evidence, and that this would become a police matter, that the police, as Gill Valley's employer, would, first of all, get him off the force, take away his gun, fire him because he was for conduct unbefitting an officer. And then, she would either divorce him or they would enter counseling, or at any rate, this wouldn't be a criminal matter. That's what he thinks should happen and should have happened in this case. I should mention the case isn't over. He was convicted, but he has not been sentenced, and that's because his defense team has petitioned the judge to throw out the verdict.
And on what basis?
That it was a pre-crime case, that the prosecution spent too much time intimating what sort of things Valley might do in the future and not enough time actually arguing the particulars of the case.
Mm-hmm.
They feel that the waters were muddied enough that the jury was tainted by this discussion.
Mm-hmm.
The judge has been asked, it's been months now, the judge hasn't given a decision yet, but it's expected any time now.
Mm-hmm. And what's the current sentence that he got?
Well, he hasn't been sentenced yet.
Oh, he hasn't been sentenced yet.
If the judge decides not to toss out the verdict, then he faces a sentence of up to life in prison.
Mm-hmm. What about the other guys who he was? He had about two or three other guys he was talking to on the Dark Fetish Network. What's happened to them?
Well, one of the things the defense said was that, why weren't his co-conspirators apprehended right away, just like him, if this really was a conspiracy? But eventually, the FBI did pick up Michael Van Hise in New Jersey, who he had been talking with, and they accused him of crimes unrelated to Gill Valley, of discussions unrelated to Valley. And then Van Hise cooperated and led them to two more individuals who now face charges also unrelated to anything that Valley did on this website. But the interesting thing is that they caught those guys in a sting where they found more physical evidence. They mm-hmm. arranged a meeting in a park where one of them brought weapons. And so it was a little bit more like these sex predator cases, these sting operations where there's physical evidence to prove the case.
Right. Do you feel, has there been a lot of legal attention on this verdict and what it means for, thought prosecutions in America?
I'm not sure there's been enough legal attention on this. I think a lot of defense lawyers look at it and go, oh, that's terrible. It was all in his head. But they understand that because it's a conspiracy case, the barrier to proof is so low that it would be really, really hard to fight back on it. But I do believe a lot of eyes are watching the judge now to see what he says faced with this decision of whether or not to toss out the verdict and have a new trial.
Okay, well, we'll be watching too. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
I've been speaking with Robert Kolker of New York Magazine. His article, A Dangerous Mind, appears in the January 13th issue of the magazine. And Robert, again, thanks so much for speaking with us today.